Hey, listener, how many bottles of wine do you have stored away somewhere waiting for a special occasion to open? If your answer is more than 10, listen up. In this conversation with Ray Isle of Food & Wine magazine, he gives you all the reasons why you should drink the cellar. This is the Inside Wine Podcast. I'm Joe Janisch, offering you insider tips to make the right wine decisions. And today our guest is Ray Isle, the executive wine editor for Food & Wine magazine. Ray, thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Wine Podcast.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So if our listener doesn't know you, if they haven't seen you on Food & Wine magazine or way back in the day when you were the managing editor of Wine & Spirits magazine, you've also written it for Departures, Travel & Leisure, Time magazine. You've conducted seminars all over the United States. You've been on the Today Show. You even had that TV show with Stanley Tucci.
I did.
Vine Talk.
One great season.
It was, you know, it looked like you guys were having a lot of fun when you were doing the show.
We had a great time. It was not financially the most effective show, but but we enjoyed ourselves for sure.
Yeah, you guys definitely enjoyed yourselves. And I'm sure you got to meet a lot of interesting people on that show. I actually watched several of those episodes and it looked like a lot of fun.
Cool. Yeah. There are all sorts of ways I could have thought that we could have done it better if we'd had a second season of the thing, but it's difficult doing shows for public television because you can't accept advertising. And then, of course, you can't accept sponsorships from the subject that you're having a show about, which would be wine. So we can't accept sponsorships from wineries and it can't accept advertising, which puts your financial situation in a kind of bleak state.
It makes it kind of difficult.
Yeah.
But, you know, Seinfeld's first season wasn't that great. You know, they could have given you another one.
That's true. I wish, you know, someone should have pointed that out at the time. We could have been gone for like 13 seasons after that. So,
yeah. Anyway, so you've been in the business for at least 20 years now in the wine business through the years. And I've been in the business since 96. And, you know, our listener may not quite understand this, but there's kind of a... I'd call it like a perk, but also a curse in the fact that we know a lot about wine and we get to figure out which bottles are really cool and we pick up a few and throw them in our cellar. And I know I'm guilty of it. I have a few dozen bottles or so stashed in the closet over the last 20 years. And we learn that we're supposed to age some of these wines. We're supposed to put them away. We're supposed to open them up at just the right time. And it doesn't always work out that way.
No, it doesn't. I just the other day opened up a white Burgundy, Premier Cru white Burgundy that definitely should have been opened up like 6 years ago. And it wasn't even premature oxidation. It was just solely operator error on my part. And it's tricky because, I mean, if you're in the business, you usually end up with a fair amount of wine and you also become, I think, in a way that consumers don't, you're kind of inured to there being a lot of wine going back and forth and everything. So you honestly, I think a lot of us don't keep track as much or as carefully as we might. And so occasionally there's that thing where you open a box, you're like, oh, yeah, I should have drunk those. Oh, well, time for sauce, you know, just throw them in the pot.
Yeah, again, our listener probably can't connect with this. They're like, oh, yeah, it must be nice. You open up a box and there's a whole bunch of wine in there. Why didn't you drink it?
You know? Yeah, if you're in the, I don't know, shoe business, apparently, you know, or whatever, sometimes you must go into your garage and be like, oh, shoot, samples. I forgot about those. They're 10 seasons old, you know.
There you go. That's a good comparative. I like that. I like that. So we're recording this right now in the middle of September in 2020. We're still in the midst of the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
And at the beginning of the pandemic, you started doing something on Instagram called WTF.
Yes, exactly.
We won't say that. We won't say what those means. Right. You probably just mean with the flock. and basically, you're raiding your cellar of all of the bottles that you've been storing up for the past many years.
Yeah.
And that's why we're having you on today, because so many people have trouble like trying to figure out when should they open that bottle? When is the right time? And Ray, I think you've kind of turned that on its head. Like, now is the right time.
Yeah, well, now's the right time. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It just kind of came to me at some point when I was stuck in my apartment with nowhere to go, thinking, why don't I drink these wines? When you're kind of faced with something like COVID and you're thinking, well, who knows how long life is going to be anyway. Yeah. But it got sort of surprisingly positive reaction online, which I thought was, I was a little worried it was going to come off like, you know, I'm showing off all these nice wines that I'm drinking and people would be like, you're a jerk. You know, it's like, stop doing that. But I think people kind of appreciated the sentiment behind it. And it, and you know, it's funny, I think that we talked about this, you know, at one point, not in the context of podcast, but it came out a little bit out of something that happened when, you know, the Food Wine Classic in Aspen is our big, huge wine and food event that we do every year, except this one. We had to turn it virtual this year. But a few years back, a woman came up to me, and apparently the year before she came up to me, she had been in my seminar, and she said, and I had said something along the lines of, you know, we amass all these wines. If you have, if you're a wine collector, if you're someone who keeps wine, you know, you amass all these wines and you worry about when to drink them and when's the right time to drink them. And life, you know, could be short and shorter than one thinks. Sometimes you could be hit by a bus, you know, walking across the street. And she came up to me, and this was apparently the year after I said this. And she said, you know, I just wanted to thank you because I was in your seminar last year and I heard you say this. And I went back and my husband and I had a fairly substantial wine collection. And I was like, then I told him we should drink these. We shouldn't just sit on them forever. And so they, and she said they started having really good wine, you know, every week or every, you know, every few days out of their cellar. And apparently he had a heart condition and he actually passed away in between when I had said that and the year she came up to talk to me. And,
oh my God.
Yeah. And she said, you know, I just want to say thanks. Cause if you hadn't said that, I never would have thought to do that. We never would have had this time together drinking all this wonderful wine that we bought together. And you're right. It's like, you know, life can be short and things can happen that are unexpected. And so, you know, why not drink the cellar? WTF, drink the cellar.
God.
And so I think that in the context of COVID and everything going on and worrying about like my mom's in a retirement community and that kind of thing, I just thought, yeah, why not drink all this wine? Who cares if it's maybe not quite the right year to drink it? If it's too young, put it in a decanter. It's too old, make nice sauce with it. You know? And so I just started this thing going. And then actually a number of other people kind of picked it up and started doing it, which was really fun. And plus, tasted great, too. I drank a lot of wines that I sort of was kind of thinking I should hang on to longer. It turned out, in fact, they were spectacular.
Wow. Ray, that story is unbelievable. Being in the wine business, wine is serious. But generally, there's not serious stuff that usually happens in the wine business. It's a pretty impactful thing. Crazy.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I think at the wine business, you know, you sell wine to people. Goes to an importer, goes to a retailer, someone buys the bottle, they take it home, they drink it. You never know what their reaction was. You hope they had a great time drinking it. And it's a little bit the same thing with writing for a magazine or website. I mean, you know, Food and Wine has a circulation of close to 1 million. I don't hear back from everybody who reads my articles. If I did, my email would be inundated.
Yeah, right.
You know, you never actually know what effect you have, if any. So it was really kind of a remarkable moment of in person, my God, like I actually had an effect on someone's life simply for being in the wine business.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, it doesn't have to be dead serious, obviously. You know, it's also just fun to unearth some things you put away for a while and drink them and then replace them with something else, you know?
Yeah. Now you have room for something else to store for 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. You talked about being worried about showing off everything you've been drinking, and I can understand how you could have that point of view, especially with some of the bottles that I've seen there on Instagram that you've been popping open. But you've always done such a great job of having fun with wine and making it accessible to people and being goofy every once in a while, you know, so I think that's part of why it's been such a success and why so many people have been really tagging along on this and having fun with you. It's been a tough time for a lot of people. And
yeah, I mean, wine is fun. Wine is a respite from everything that's going on. It has, I mean, what I've always fought against, you know, wine has kind of an innate perception of pretentiousness that just is very hard to get rid of. You know, it's like no matter what we do to try and stomp it out, people comes back and people are like, yeah, wine's snooty, wine's pretentious. And it's not. I mean, it's fermented grape juice and like peasants have drunk it, you know, through the centuries, kings have drunk it, everybody's drunk wine. And I think because I didn't grow up in a wine drinking family at all and came to it kind of late, I always have had and continue to think of myself, even after being in the business a long time, as someone who I still remember saving up my graduate school $14 for my weekly wine buy and valuing that. That's, you know, it's like you don't have to spend a fortune. You don't have to buy collectible wines to enjoy wine and to fall in love with it. And that's a very important part of this business. You know, that's where people enter into the wine world, I think, is that affordable level and the non-pretentious level. It shouldn't be something that's off-putting to people. And I do my best to make it not off-putting as best I can.
Yeah. And you do a great job of that.
Thanks.
So what was the wine for you that kind of turned on the light bulb? Everybody pretty much has a wine that they remember. What was it for you?
Yeah, there were two of them actually, right about the same time. One was when I was, this was a while back, but this is quite a while back, but I was having dinner with a long ago former girlfriend and her father. I don't think I was even interested in wine at the point. Well, this was like in, the late 80s, I want to say. And he had been to Diamond Creek in Napa Valley on a business trip. And this was in Washington, D.C. at a restaurant called Restaurant Nora that I'm not sure if it still exists or not. I think they closed a few years ago, but it was kind of an early on destination restaurant in D.C. And so he ordered a bottle of Diamond Creek Volcanic Hill in 1984. We were drinking it about 4 or 5 years after the vintage. And I remember sitting there, you know, and what I should have been doing was paying attention to what my girlfriend's father was saying. And I remember just sitting there after a couple of sips of that wine, I guess, thinking, it's like, God, this stuff is amazing. This is like, I've never had anything like this in my life. And so it kind of kickstarted my interest in trying to find something that would be that good, that maybe wasn't quite that expensive, though things were cheaper back then. But so I started going to wine stores and looking for wines. I probably bought, like right after that, I bought the Hugh Johnson Pocket Guide to Wine that is now in its 35th or 36th edition. Used that as a guide. And then around the same time, almost within a few weeks, I want to say, I was working in a rare bookstore and a woman came in the door and she's like, you know, I have this expletive Jaguar that keeps breaking down everywhere I go. And can I use your phone? I was like, oh, sure, lady, you can use the phone. You know, it's a wealthy DC socialite person. And she used the phone, called a wrecker to tow the Jaguar away. And then she turned up again a few days later and she basically would want to say thanks and dropped off a bottle of white Burgundy, a Montigny.
Wow.
Not expensive white Burgundy, but nice enough. It was a Montigny. I can't remember the producer. But again, that I took it home. I opened it. It was a really lovely white wine. And so I kind of went on a quest to find the same bottle because I knew she must have bought it somewhere around. And that was another of those kind of kickstart your interest both in the flavors and the appreciation of how good wine can be, but also the kind of fun of poking around in wine stores trying to find bottles that you haven't had before, which I think is an underrated part of how people get into wine. It is definitely daunting to walk into a wine store when you don't know anything about wine and there's a wall of like 175 Chardonnays.
Exactly.
I don't know. Let's see. There are 32 that cost, you know, $18.99. Which one do I buy? But at the same time, once you start getting into wine, you go to a wine store and you're like, there's all this stuff. Like there's so many different things I could buy. And once the bug bites you, basically, it's really fascinating. And it's great when I sort of talk to people at seminars that we've done back when we could actually gather in person and so on, or email with people who are, you know, on social media who are just getting into wine, that you catch that kind of excitement about, you know, they've never had a Cru Beaujolais or they never had a take your pick, you know, Dolcetto or something like that. And they want to know all about it, you know. And that's a neat thing.
Once you catch the bug, you're kind of hooked. Yeah. You're just hooked.
It's also interesting because I definitely have know some people and worked with some people who simply don't catch the bug. They're like, yeah, wine, it's good. I've had a bunch of wine. It's all right. you know, you're kind of like, you're wired very differently from me, clearly.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So, but that's to each their own.
Well, toward that end, like what you've been doing now with Drink in the Cellar, a lot of us watching are kind of living through you and being able to experience a lot of wines that maybe we wouldn't have had before, or maybe we wouldn't have thought of before. So how many bottles do you think you have in your cellar?
I have, let's see, in terms of bottles, somewhere around 1,000, I would say. It's about 80 cases of wine.
Yeah, it's time to go through them. Yeah, it's time.
It's time to go through them. And there are definitely some where I was looking at them going, you know, and I store my wines off. Well, I live in a New York apartment, so I store my wines elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I've definitely gone through, this has caused me to go through the list of what's there and think, wait, should have drunk that. But the other thing is that a lot of what stuff I have, and so a lot of stuff I've been posting is not, it's not super pricey, even
it's
if
not.
It ages beautifully. I mean, that's,
yeah,
that's also one of the things that I try and get across to readers and so on, is that, you know, Grand Cru Burgundy ages beautifully. You know, first growth Bordeaux ages beautifully. But there's a lot of wine out there that's under $50, let's say, or even under $35, that can hang out in a cellar for 10 or 15 years and develop beautifully. And I've been kind of posting all over the place with that. Some expensive stuff. And it is funny, on social media, if you basically, in my Drink the Cellar thing, if you post a kind of like unicorn you know, Psalm Candy wine. Yeah. You get a lot of responses from the restaurant world and the wine community. And if you, but if you post something that's not necessarily as culty sought after, but affordable and also spectacular, then you start getting questions from the non-wine people, which is really great. You know, I think people basically Google things really quickly and look up a older bottle of high-end Burgundy, and they're like, I think I won't be buying that today. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, you can get a Crow's Hermitage that ages gorgeously for $35, more or less. Crow's Hermitage is starting to go above that, but you know, whatever.
Well, back when you bought it, it was probably only $35.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's also the classic thing is you look, you know, occasionally there are price tags on things and you're like, wow, that was not expensive. You know, there's some high-end Napa stuff from back when high-end Napa stuff was, I don't know, $50 a bottle or whatever. Now it's $250. Or Burgundy is Burgundy is really the one that's gone just completely crazy.
Yeah, you can't touch anything under $75, $80, $100. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, for village wines.
Yeah.
And, you know, it used to be that, I mean, everybody knows this, it's in the business, but the prices of Burgundy have far outstripped the basic inflation rate. And it's a pity because it's, you know, they're such gorgeous wines, but I mean, I don't buy much Premier, certainly not Grand Cru Burgundy. I'm a journalist. I don't make that much money.
And I'm in the wine business. I can't afford them either.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're looking at, you know, so it's the classic Bill Gates thing that if Bill Gates drops $100, it's not actually worth his time to stop and pick it up because it's the 5 seconds he makes more money than if he stopped to pick up the $100. So that's who's buying the Burgundy, I guess.
Yeah. And it is a shame because Burgundy was actually the thing that had me catch the bug. I had a red Burgundy long time ago then that, and it just flicked the switch for me. And they're such beautiful wines, the reds and the whites. And it is a shame because I think more people probably would get into wine if they had a chance to just taste one of those.
Absolutely. Especially with sort of popularity of Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir is a great success story in California and Oregon. And yet the kind of models that drove New World winemakers to lean into Pinot Noir, those models are now wildly too expensive. So that you've got people who fall in love with Pinot Noir and then they can't really fall in love with Burgundy the same way. So, I mean, it is a cliche, but Burgundy is also one of the more, how to put it, you know, it's gorgeous when it's gorgeous and then it's disappointing as hell.
Really disappointing. Yeah. Really disappointing. Yeah.
You know, and there's always a slight worry that, you know, the bottle you thought was going to turn out great, it's going to end up being this sort of attenuated, overly tannic, not much fruit left thing, but which is a much, makes it scarier when you're talking about spending $90 a bottle as opposed to $35.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's all the more reason you should open up your bottles in the cellar because.
Yeah. And the other thing I always tell people when I do seminars or anything about collecting wine is just don't buy one bottle, buy more than one bottle, you know, because otherwise you sit there with your one bottle, like, should I open it?
Yep. I'm waiting.
And then usually what I tell people is like, by the end of this decision-making process, you'll actually die and your kids will drink it. So, you know, you will never make up your mind and then your kids will drink your wine.
Yeah.
So, which is nice for them, but maybe not kind of the point of the whole exercise.
Yeah, I know. I definitely have a few bottles that I just keep pulling out of the closet and I look at it and I'm like, oh, I should probably drink this tonight. I'm like, but I'm just having a hamburger, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny, I, with the sort of WTF drink the cellar thing, I've been primarily posting what I've been cooking with it too, because I cook all the time. I mean, basically you work at a food magazine for 15 years. If you don't learn to cook.
Yeah. You work for food and wine, Ray. So
there's something wrong with you. But sometimes a hamburger and a great bottle of Bordeaux is exactly the thing that goes together perfectly. It's really that you don't have to have fancy food with fancy wine necessarily, but it is tough when it's one bottle, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and you're sitting there looking at it going like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I feel like opening that right now. You know, maybe I'll open it. Maybe I won't open it.
Well, when in doubt, just open it up, right? I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, life could be short.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
going through your cellar, were there any bottles that like completely surprised you that like, or maybe some discoveries you were like, I can't even believe like I put this away. I should have drank this 2 weeks after I bought it, or like anything that like really blew you away.
Yeah. It's interesting. One, your tastes change, you know, so there are some pretty heavy California Zinfandels that I put away that I don't honestly, I mean, I do think some Zins age beautifully, but a lot of these wines just weren't meant to, they were sort of from early on in my career. They weren't meant to be put away. I find that, well, for one thing, I started out in the port business before I was writing full time. I worked selling port.
Oh, cool.
And selling port is one of those sort of Sisyphean pursuits where you wander around the city with a bag of wine and you're like, yes, I placed a bottle. I got a bottle. I sold a bottle. You know, you're like, that's my day. Thank God. And, you know, you come back like 6 months later, like, no, we still got that bottle. So, but I have, as a result, a lot of vintage port, and I love vintage port, but I don't drink that much vintage port.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you really have to have people around to justify opening a 750 of vintage port.
Yes. And a big chunk of blue cheese too.
Yeah. And so basically, thank God it ages really well for a long time, because I'm moving very slowly through that stuff. And I've had, you know, the surprising, I'd say the category of wine that surprised me the most in terms of actually aging really well has been California Chardonnay. Hmm. Certainly not from every producer, but from the really good producers of California Chardonnay, particularly the ones who had a little bit more of a restrained kind of sensibility. Those wines, they're underestimated in terms of how nicely they develop over time.
It's funny you say that, because the thing that was going through my head, you know, I work in public relations for co-brand, so we have like the keywords that come up for the different articles that come up. There was a blog post that came up recently. Someone had a bottle of Sequoia Grove. It was like 15 or 16 years old, and they forgot they had it, and they opened it up and they said it was beautiful. Now, trust me, Sequoia Grove Chardonnay is one of my favorites, and it's a beautiful wine, but I never would expect it to last 15 years. I mean,
yeah, those wines will age and age and age, but that's been a surprise and a kind of a relief, because I actually have more than I expected of that category of wine. And I have more sweet wine cellar than I probably want to drink.
Oh, just, yeah. I have cases, you know, of sweet wine that I'll never drink.
Yeah.
I just never have an occasion to do it.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, I'll say to my wife, you know, should we open up the bottle? It's like, nah, I don't feel like a bunch of sweet wine at the moment. And so I've got some weird old Alsace SGNs and things like that.
But that's what I have. I have SGNs from 89. I'm just like, when am I going to open this
thing? Yeah, what, when, why, how, you know.
So. They're gorgeous, but.
And then the other category of stuff that I'm thrilled that I put some away of is champagne.
Oh, interesting.
I don't think I even recognized how well it ages until fairly far along in my career. That, you know, kind of restaurant and particularly sommelier love of champagne, that kind of, there's a sort of obsessiveness right now to champagne, particularly Grover champagnes, but really all champagne. But that, at least in terms of like, if you go back 14, 15 years, which is a while, but you know, it wasn't nearly as intense. And I think that people weren't thinking about cellaring it quite as much. And even Brut non-vintage champagne can age gorgeously for a long time. And those wines, if you like that sort of more toasty, mushroomy, or savory characteristic, you know,
yeah,
kind of honey brittle and things like that, it's beautiful wines. So I'm fortunate because I kind of cellared them without even thinking that I was cellaring them. It's more like I gotta do something with all this goddamn champagne. Yeah. That was happy good fortune.
That's surprising to me, because through the years, the different champagne experts have told me, like, you don't want to age the champagne in the cellar too long because they're aging it for you. And I didn't realize it could develop.
Yeah, I think particularly tête de cuvée stuff can age really spectacular. I mean, you know, yes, it's released when it's ready to drink. I mean, you guys have Tête de Comte de Champagne. I mean, it's gorgeous when it's released. There's no question. But that wine will also age further in a cellar easily. And it's, you know, it's that combination of high acidity and a certain amount of suspended CO2 in the wine that kind of slows down the oxidation process, from what I understand. Someone who has a chemistry background can call me out on that, but I think that's the case. You know, goes to my favorite wine joke, which is, you know, how many bubbles are in a bottle of champagne? And there's none until you open it.
And then they're all gone about 10 minutes later.
Yeah, yes. It's like the wine equivalent of a dad joke.
So what would have been like some key learnings that you've figured out from opening up all these bottles from different years and aging them? Like anything that, you know, our listener can take away with if they have some things in their cellar, anything that like you learned from all this?
Yeah, I think, you know, I have learned that a random night is a good context for opening a really nice bottle of wine. It doesn't have to be a special occasion. If you have a fair amount of wine on hand. I have also learned that if you start aging things for a long time, you're going to have misses. You're going to have stuff that didn't make it, which is one reason why, again, I mean, I have a lot of one-offs in my cellar just because the nature of being a journalist, people send you random stuff and you're like, end up with a couple bottles you throw in the cellar. But I think that it's always good if you have six bottles of something to taste one at least a little before you think it's going to be ready, a couple of years before, just to see where it is on the curve, and then you can kind of extrapolate, you know, where it's going to land. And again, I think the other thing is that, and this has been proved by everything I've been opening, it does not have to be expensive wine to age beautifully. You know, you can do baseline German Rieslings that can, you know, are not expensive, cabinets and things like that, that can age gorgeously for a long time. So that's kind of a takeaway too. And make sure that you have a significant other who likes wine. That's the other crucial thing.
Yeah, well, that helps too.
Or buy a Corvin if you don't.
Yeah, exactly. The buying the six bottles at a time thing, definitely, because to your point, I've looked at some bottles and I've opened some up and I'm like, oh darn, it just wasn't ready. I should have waited another year or another 6 months or another 2 years or whatever it is.
Yeah. It's that, and you decant it, you wait an hour and you taste it, you wait another hour and you taste it. You're like, this is just not going to open up.
Yeah.
This is just not. And then there's the other flip side of that, which is the, you open it, you taste it, you're like, ooh, that's pretty tired.
It's like, yeah. And that's worse.
Maybe if I give it some air, it'll get better. It's like, nah, it just get better. It just gets worse. It's like cork taint. It's like, yeah, maybe it'll go away. It's like, no, it just gets worse and worse.
I think the takeaway for me has been like, it's probably worse to open it up and you missed it than to open it up too early.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you missed it, it's just not that much fun to drink. And if you open it up too early, at the very least, it's pleasant and good. You just are aware it might have been better down the line. I was talking with a winemaker in France once, and he said that this is a family property, goes back, you know, generations, and his father he'd gone down to the cellar to pick out a bottle for a friend of his, and he was going to get a birth year bottle, and on the bins in the cellar, the father had written on this particular birth year, you know, horrible year, put these away only for historical retrospective information, you know, not worth drinking, you know, worst year ever. And so he looked at it, he's like, okay, well, it is his birth year. I'll grab one of those and I'll grab the year next to it, which is supposed to be a good year. Of course, the guy was born around the same time, so he was around for the harvests. They took them to his friend's house. They opened them. The bottle from the horrible year was actually drinking quite well. And the bottle from the year that was ostensibly good 30 years down the line, 35 years down the line, was, you know, dead as a doornail. So there is, I mean, even for winemakers, there's unpredictability to this thing. And when you get into really long aging.
Well, then maybe I'm going to cellar my 2014 Brunellos.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good idea. I'm very fortunate. My daughter was born in 2002, which is a spectacularly good champagne year. Yeah. So I'm just, the only trick is not drinking the few bottles I put away for her.
Just really quickly, you mentioned a couple times decanting. What have you found with decanting the older bottles? Do they need a lot of airing time, less airing time? Do they fade away?
I find that if they're really getting up there, you know, like in that sort of 20, 25 year zone, something like that, they fade away. They can fade away pretty quickly. I mean, I always sort of pull the cork on things at least half an hour, if not a little bit longer than that, before I'm going to drink them. And I just taste some amount to see whether it needs decanting or whether I should just jam the cork right back in.
Yeah.
Right. But old wines are fragile and certainly things like Pinot and so on can be more delicate as they get older too. I mean, port, for instance, is pretty forgiving, but it is a good way to kill a wine pretty quickly. The really old wines can kind of vanish quite quickly if they get a ton of air. And as long as you stand them up for a while and pour carefully, you don't really have to worry about sediment that much.
So you pour it right from the bottle then, in that case, if you think it's...
Yeah, I do. And part of this is because I did work in the port business. I spent a lot of time decanting port. so I have a relatively steady hand. But yeah, in that case, I would just pour right from the bottle. And the other thing is I'm a big fan of decanting younger wines.
That's what I do.
And whites and reds.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I think that some younger whites can really benefit from a fair amount of air, or at least like, poured into a glass and splash around a bit and then sit there for 20 minutes, especially if they're coming straight out of a fridge because they're too cold anyway.
You need to warm them up anyway, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the classic U.S. approach, which is we put the whites in the fridge so they're too cold, and we keep the reds on the counter so they're too warm. For Wine 101 things, I always tell people, like, take the whites out of the fridge 30 minutes before you drink them and put the reds in the fridge for 30 minutes before you drink them. It works pretty well. But Yeah.
I know some people that decant like Tuscan wines for like hours. Do you ever do that? Or
yeah. No, I mean, I never actually get my act together to do that just because, I don't know, somehow that many hours seem to be doing something else.
Yeah, I'm more spontaneous than that too.
Yeah. And the other thing is if I really think it's hard as nails, and it, I mean, I'm in a good position of having ridiculous amount of wine just sitting around my apartment because I'm constantly tasting for work.
Right. It's your job.
Yeah. So it's my job. I mean, it's what I do. I taste wine and I write about it. So if I open something like a young Tuscan wine that's really just hard as nails and I decant it for an hour and it's still just going nowhere, I'll just wait and try it the next day. You know, a lot of powerful, young vintage, massively tannic wines honestly could be better the next day sometimes, I find. Mm-hmm. It's a wine by wine call, you know. Also kind of depends on how many people are over and how thirsty we are.
Yeah.
but these days,
nobody's over. Yeah.
Nobody's over. So, and sometimes also with what I've taken to doing, and this is actually kind of a handy thing. If you do own a Coravin, not so much for long-term storage, but for older, really old wines, the corks are dry and the Coravin can sometimes like eject the cork out of the bottle. But for stuff you cellared, sometimes it's good to just like Coravin out an ounce of it, taste it, and then figure out from that whether you want to pull the cork, whether you don't, whether you want to decant it once you pull the cork, whether you want to decant it for 2 hours or something. You know, I mean, Coravin was intended where you could pull half the bottle out, you know, or if you're a restaurant, you could do glass by glass pours. But it's also just a great test process.
Yeah.
For one simple taste of a wine to see where it is in its lifespan.
Yeah, that's a good tip.
Yeah,
that's a really good tip. And for the people who don't have the optimal cellar conditions, where if they're actually storing their wine in the New York City apartment,
yeah,
probably should open those bottles up.
Oh yeah,
sooner rather than later, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, if you don't have temperature control and you're trying to do long-term storage, you're basically out of luck. That's the one thing that just doesn't work. If you got New York apartment temperatures that go up and down, and you know it's like 78 or something in the summer some of the time when you're on vacation, you know, if you're trying to store something for a year, you'll probably be okay. If you're trying to store it for 10 years, you're probably going to kill it. And it's an unfortunate expense, but if you can get a small wine fridge and at least put your most valuable bottles in that, or get some kind of offsite storage for things that you really want to store for 10 or 20 years, it's really the only thing to do, because otherwise you're just kind of wasting wine. You'll open it and you'll be dismayed down the line. I mean, for 6 months or a year or two, I mean, a lot of wines will survive that just fine. But for long-term storage, no.
Yeah. 10 years ain't going to cut it.
Yeah. Not at all. Yeah.
All right. So if our listener has not yet been convinced of why they should be opening up some bottles, do you have any more explanation?
Well, yeah, because I mean, it's assuming that, you know, your financial situation hasn't changed drastically, which you can't assume for people right now, but opening up bottles gives you a chance to go out and buy more bottles.
There you go.
And it's fun. You know, it's fun to replenish your cellar. And it's also, you know, the only way to learn about what older wines taste like is to taste older wines. And if you do have wines in your cellar and you haven't been drinking them, I mean, it's educational as well. It's, you know, it teaches you kind of how, what the lifespan of these things are and what the arc is. And plus it's just delicious. You know, it's just like, it can, if you've had a shitty day, it's sorry, you can bleep me.
It's okay.
But a really great bottle of wine can really bring that day back into a better place. And so sometimes that's the answer I find, you know?
Yeah. And that's kind of why we drink wine to begin with, right?
Yeah, kind of exactly.
Just enjoy life.
Yeah. So it is an aid to enjoying life up to a point. Yeah, don't, you know, right. Yeah. don't overdo the enjoying life, you know, but
yeah, three bottles a night, probably not a good.
Yeah, it's probably that's
not
it,
a good plan. Cool. Ray, this is really cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Joe. Thanks, Joe, for having me on. That's great.
Yeah. And thank you for rating your cellar and doing all that on Instagram. Why don't you tell our listener where they can connect with you if they're not already connected?
Yeah. So I'm on Instagram at Ray Isle. So at Ray Isle. And Isle is spelled like an isle out in the ocean. And so that's it. And then on Twitter, I'm on, weirdly enough, I will explain why, I'm Isle Wine. And the reason I'm Isle Wine is because there is a retired guy in Australia who lives on Raymond Island off the coast of Melbourne. And And he got Ray Isle before I got there.
There you go.
So and he like posts once a year about Australian soccer or something. So, but yeah, so Isle Wine on Twitter, Ray Isle on Instagram, and then basically if you Google Ray Isle Wine,
we'll find you
plenty of stuff, more than you want.
Yeah, and I'll put the links in the show notes too, so you can just swipe left or up or down or whatever it is.
Oh, great, perfect, excellent. Yeah, that's that's a drink the cellar, everybody. Yeah, the only thing to do, don't drink the cellar so you can replenish the cellar.
There you go. Thanks for listening to my conversation with Ray Isle. We hope you've been convinced to open at least some of those bottles kicking around your cellar. And if you enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Inside Wine podcast so you can get the next episode delivered to your podcast app automatically. In the meantime, remember, wine is food, it comes from a place, enjoy it responsibly.